Hey, everybody. Welcome to the BEV podcast. I am your occasional host, Jason Tondro, and I am here with a very special guest, Chris Sims, a longtime friend of mine and a guy to whom I have enormous respect and am deeply grateful for. Thanks for coming on the show, Chris.
No problem. I like to be here.
Now, Chris, many of you will already know Sims by his name and reputation, but for those of you that don't, you started at Wizards of the Coast on third edition. Back yep. More than 15 years ago.
Yeah. I started working for Wizards in 2003.
And you were how far into the third edition line was that?
I think it was right at the 3.5 transition.
Oh yeah.
I'm not sure though. That's a long time ago.
Yeah.
My first project was Sandstorm, the Sandstorm book.
Oh yeah, I know. I remember Sandstorm. I like that book. Yeah, especially these days where it seems like the month of March took like 10 years, right? Yeah. thinking back to 2003, it's like another lifetime ago.
When I started freelancing for Wizards, I actually started working in the Wizards office, and I actually started as a TCG editor. Monday after Katrina hit. So
really?
That was 2005.
Tell us about some of the story.
What do you mean?
Well, like how did you get into that, doing that?
Oh, well, so I got back into D&D with third edition. I hadn't been playing it for a long time, actually. I started gaming by playing D&D.
Yeah.
What I started doing was I was really interested in third edition. So I started reading things and I got really into the rules and stuff like that. And I started reviewing third party projects on EN World, actually. My reviews were pretty technical, so people noticed that they were technical and they would say, well, you're right about these technical aspects, would you like to edit our next project?
Nice.
And I said, oh, you want to pay me to edit your book? Sure. Then right about that time in 2003, Wizards had an open call for editors.
Yeah.
And I took the editing test and they hired me to be a freelance.
What was the editing test like? I mean, I've done editing tests for Paizo myself, so I'm curious.
Having done a development test for Paizo and a development test for Wizards, and so they're pretty similar. So they have things that you would have to do on the job.
Yeah.
In the test, and there are things wrong with them, and it's about what you change and how you change it and why you change it.
Lots of show your work.
Right. And even in the interview, they might ask you why you changed something on the test, like, or what you were thinking about when you did it. So
interesting.
It's pretty in depth, actually. It's comparable to writing tests for other jobs, because I've done writing tests for video game companies.
Okay.
And they can be pretty in depth.
Yeah.
And I feel like the tests for editing positions and for design positions in role-playing games, they're usually, if you don't already have the resume, right, they're going to be pretty in depth. And sometimes they are pretty in depth anyway. I mean, I took a development test before I signed on at Paizo.
Yeah.
And it was a pretty in depth test. I mean, so.
Yeah, I think I took the development test when I took your job, when I took your seat after you left. But so let's talk about
that. I helped grade those. So.
Yeah, I probably wrote some of that. Like, I remember, did you design the troll? There was like a, so the development test, we got like this troll monster. It was basically a giant blob. It was like a piece of troll flesh that got cut off of a troll and it gained sentience on its own.
And no, that was Owen.
Oh, that was Owen.
that was actually out of that monster is from Flight of the Sleepers.
Yeah, yeah.
So
everything gets moved eventually. Yeah. All right. So let's get to that.
And actually, almost every design test that I've taken from any company has used their actual their turnover stuff, like the design turnover stuff.
Yeah.
Very rarely has it been doctored severely, but sometimes you can tell it's been doctored, like something's been changed to or something ridiculous, right? So,
so. Yeah, right. So you were at Wizards for third and fourth edition, and also into fifth edition.
Right. I was there for the latter half of third edition, and the capstone of that was compiling and editing the rules compendium for third edition.
Oh, that was a fantastic book. I'll use that thing every damn day. Yeah.
And it was a fun project. I got to talk to a lot of character optimization people while I was doing that. Got to really understand the concept of additive interpretation in that situation.
That's what you mean by additive interpretation.
It means that you read something into the rule that is not there.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Often the defense of additive interpretation is that another similar rule stated something in a different way.
Yeah.
So because that part isn't in this rule, it must be purposefully excluded. Often it's because helper text was added to a previous rule, like for example, or a parenthetical. And because it's not in another version of a similar rule, people say it's not the same when it's intended to be the same.
So you get like, it doesn't say I can't do it this way, so it must be that I can.
Right. And that's one of the reasons why in fifth edition, I really, really wanted them to put, and I think that they did, that the rules are built on exclusions.
Yeah.
So one general rule here will say you can't do this. But if another rule says, another more specific rule says that you can, you can.
Yeah.
In that specific instance. So it's exclusions based. Getting people to understand what exclusions based means was important.
That's a challenge.
Yeah.
All right. So you were at fifth. You worked on fifth.
Right. I was a technical editor for fifth. So, which was a lot of fun. I worked a lot on spells in the player's handbook and stuff like that. And I really worked on the monster manual, mostly on the narrative concepts of the monsters and stuff like that. I was not involved in the final numbers that are in the book, but I was involved in the design of the basic. Like, Chris Perkins and I are the reason why there are differences between how monsters petrify in the monster manual.
Okay, yeah.
And the Medusa is the scariest version, right? That's on purpose. That's intentional.
Yeah. Well, that allows you to use a low-level petrification monsters like a cockatrice.
Right.
Without it being instant death.
Right.
Or nerfing it so bad that the Medusa is no longer scary.
Right.
Right? Yeah. But then you came to Paizo. And you were hired by Paizo to work on Starfinder.
That's correct. To be an adventure path developer.
Starfinder exploded at Gen Con a few years ago, and they were cannibalizing staff from the rest of Paizo. And what I have been told, correct me if this is wrong, but Owen got you, suggested you for this job.
I think Owen was a proponent of my hiring. I think that probably Logan Bonner and Stephen Radney McFarland also were.
Right,
who worked because
they
had worked with me at Wizards.
Yeah.
I think that they asked Owen and Steven and Logan about me. I mean, I can't be sure what actually happened. There are people who know me that were already working for Paizo, so they said that I was worth the risk, I guess.
I'm sure it was exactly the opposite, because you brought a ton of this experience and your own life experience to the game, and you started writing Adventure Paths, and you wrote and developed, you wrote the first volume of Signal of Screams.
That's right, because my mentor Jason Keeley said that I had to write an Adventure Path volume before I started really seriously developing them. So I think that's great advice. I think that knowing what it took, and knowing that it's hard, right? It's not easy.
It is really challenging.
I mean, I had written plenty of adventures before. I just hadn't written to Paizo's specific format and stuff like that. So,
and we do have a kind of, there is a sort of expectation when someone's writing or reading a Paizo adventure, that it's going to have a certain level of detail, for example, that it's going to have what the encounters are going to be like, and all of the resources you're going to need are going to be there for you.
Right.
And, you know, a D&D fifth adventure could just say, okay, there's a cave here with an owlbear in it, and it bold faces owlbear, and that's the encounter. Right. And, but we've got to have maps and stats and read aloud text and development for what happens if the owlbear gets help. And like we have a just whole different design philosophy when it comes to encounters.
Yeah. I think that D&D during third and fourth edition got more into the, what I would call Paizo's style is now.
Yeah.
And I think that Paizo's style developed from, because of Dungeon Magazine.
Yes.
Developed from doing detailed third edition adventures. Yeah. And so they were definitely no stranger to story rich, detailed encounters. I mean, that's the way third edition was done.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I remember those encounter layouts in third and fourth edition. Which were, you're, now that you mentioned it, you're right. They're very similar to what we do now for at Paizo.
And I think that Paizo took it to the next level in Dungeon. I think Dungeon was a really great magazine.
Well, it became the foundation of the company. I mean, right. You built the company on that thing.
Yeah. So I think that Paizo does some of the best adventures in the industry. So
we've had a lot of conversation about adventures lately in the office, and without getting into too many details. But we did... you're right when you say that writing an adventure path at Paizo is just really challenging. We talk about it as being sort of the top of the pyramid in terms of writing assignments.
Right.
When we get a big hardback book that's 160 pages in the case of most Starfinder books, that's always divvied out to a bunch of different freelance writers, you know, maybe dozens of them sometimes on something like an Alien Archive. And nobody writes more than, you know, 10 or 15,000 words usually. Like, that's the upper limit.
Right.
But for an adventure, you're writing an entire, well, the adventure alone is 25,000 words. Plus, you're often looped into writing one of the back matter articles or aliens or the ship or the Codex of Worlds, because all that connects to the adventure you're writing, and your assignment can easily top 30,000. And so... in terms of writing assignments, that's the single largest thing that any one person can really write at Paizo.
Right. I mean, my Signal of Screams assignment, I think, was right at 30,000.
Yeah, right. Because you did that really great article about horror gaming.
I didn't do that article. The one you're talking about is Epidia Radicals.
Is it? But then you had a bunch of – did you do the corruption article?
No, that Jason Keeley did that one.
Okay, so what did you write?
So I wrote the whole adventure, of course, and then the starship, which was part of the adventure, and then several of the aliens.
Ah, yeah. Okay.
So that's all, that's all what I wrote. But yeah, because often when you're writing an adventure, you're using something that's going to appear in the Alien Archive anyway.
Yeah, this is kind of a space saver because we don't have room for it in the adventure, so we kick it into the Alien Archive. So we can just point to it and not have to reproduce its stat block in the adventure. Yeah.
And the cool thing is that you can put an illustration in the Alien Archive that might not fit in the adventure too. So.
Yeah, that we'll end up using later for the pawns. All these things I've been learning. Now, so for those of you that don't know, Chris and I shared a cubicle wall for about 2 years. I was an editor. I came on a few months after Chris started, after you started. And I was the newest editor on the block, and you were super patient with me because I overhear all of you guys' conversations because I'm on the other side of the wall. And it took me a long time to learn how to not just pop up over the wall and start saying things. but eventually I figured it out. And you did Signal of Screams. That's what you wrote for. But then you developed Dawn of Flame.
Yeah, I was the lead developer on Dawn of Flame.
And now that that's been out for over a year now, what do you think of it? How did it turn out?
I think it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's one of those interesting things where often in a story, people want to reveal the ultimate villain really early, and this story doesn't reveal the ultimate villain until like basically the very end. I mean,
yeah.
But I don't think that it needed to. I think that the mystery of what was going on was also wrapped up in this novel exploration of something that seems impossible in normal science, right? So it seems impossible to go inside a star.
Right.
And to find these mysterious artifacts and places that you can actually explore and not just instantly be vaporized.
Right.
So, yeah, I was really pleased with it. I think that everybody did a really good job in bringing these locations to life. And
it's generally considered to be the most high fantasy of Starfinder's adventure paths.
Yeah.
Probably because of the sun aspect and because the bad guys are djinn.
Right. Yeah, and it emphasizes the magitech kind of aspect of Starfinder. Like the entire methodology by which you survive in the sun is magic tech. It's not just technology.
And we've got that giant portal that connects to the elemental plane of fire, and and the alien archives are filled with all kinds of outsiders and extraplanar entities. So it very when I often see a lot of new people come to the game, and they're like, which adventure path should I start with? And somebody always lists all of them and kind of gives them the one sentence or half a sentence characterization. And they almost always describe Dawn of Flame as the one that's got the most fantasy like feel to it, the most kind of high fantasy magic in it.
Yeah.
And that's a good corner. That's a good corner for that adventure path to fill, because a lot of people, that's what they want.
Yeah. I think that's one of the great opportunities of Starfinder, is that you could tell so many different stories that fit so many different, actually fit in many different genres. I mean, I think we've proven that.
We really have. We've got The Signal of Screams, of course, is our horror AP, and that's a 3-chapter. There was a lot of very positive feedback to the 3-volume APs.
Yeah.
I think that a 6-volume path can be a little challenging for a group to tackle.
And I think it certainly can be challenging to tackle if there's a volume coming out every month. You're not going to be finished with one 32-page adventure unless you're like playing every week.
Right.
So
yeah, you have to be pretty hardcore. I mean, did you ever listen to Non-Standard Action? You know, they played through the entire Dawn of Flame AP podcast.
I've listened to parts of it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it was super informative and wonderful fun. I love the characters, and they put so much time and work into that show. But it was really educational for me to hear how people played through those adventures and changed them, of course, from what we write.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the magic of role-playing. I think that an adventure is really just a skeleton that the story emerges from with your help at the table. It's not the story, right?
If we were writing, it's not a video game, right? Like If it's completely scripted, then it's a video game. But because you're sitting around a table and everybody can change it, and the GM can add and subtract elements to fit the people at the table, that's the magic of our hobby.
And in some ways, that's the magic of having less detail.
Out there in the woods.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure that little bit of detail is necessarily great. I mean, unless the owlbear is made interesting by some other detail somewhere else.
Right.
But it can be. I mean, that magic was there in Keep on the Borderlands. And, there's a group of pine trees and 3 giant spiders live in it. And if you wander into that area, that's what happens, So.
Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff. All right. So, you had been at Paizo for a while, and the way that developing APs works at Paizo is it sort of bounces back and forth between Keely and yourself.
Right.
And you did Dawn of Flame, and so he developed the one after that, which was
Attack of the Swarm.
Attack of the Swarm! And I remember when Keely came to the editor team and he said, can I put an exclamation point at the end of Attack of the Swarm? Because we're going to call it, the Attack of the Swarm exclamation point adventure path, period. and he wanted to get editorial sign off on that before he did something that we were all going to hate and change. Mm-hmm. So he did Attack of the Swarm, and while that was in process, you began to develop or come up with ideas for, pitch, outline, whatever was going to come next.
Right. Well, I mean, we have pitch meetings, basically, where we haul out the giant list of possible AP subject matters. And
which I have now seen, by the way. Yeah. Some of those are pretty great.
and we wish we could make them all, really, but there's just not enough time or... I mean, you know, but the
Junk Lord Hackathon, one day
go through, and I don't even remember. I mean, it's so weird because you'll be working on one AP and you'll be working on like the first couple of volumes, and then Rob will come over and say, "Hey, we need to schedule a meeting for pitching the next AP." I'm like, "We just started on this one, yeah, but we have to get the other one rolling, you know?" So, it's a strange experience, but you know the process now, don't you?
It's like a year-long development process. Yeah, it is. I had been on the team for about a month, but that's kind of an exaggeration because as soon as I got onto Star Chamber, I immediately took a two-week vacation.
the way you do it.
Yeah. I had 2 weeks saved up, and I'd already cleared the time with Judy, who was my editor, my managing editor at the time. And so when Eric came in and Amanda and they offered me the chair, I said, "Yeah, I'd love to do it, but I'm going to be gone for 2 weeks. I've got an appointment at Alcatraz. I did my West Coast tour where I started at the Cape Flattery, which is the northwesternmost point of the United States, and I drove all the way down the entire coast, all the way down south to San Diego."
Well, and they had very sharply kind of prepared for that because they knew that they wanted to be able to take their time to pick the right person and stuff like that. So they had already kind of had me on the hook for continuing development outside the office. So
that's right. Yeah. So, but to get back to your point. Yeah. So I started and I'd only been there a couple of weeks, and Rob comes over and says, "Hey, we need to have a meeting and start talking about the next AP." Mm-hmm. And of course, I completely overwrote my pitch, right? Like, I had no idea what a pitch meeting was supposed to be. And so I went in with like a 4-page outline, basically already kind of decided what I wanted to do, you know? And he was like, "This is maybe a bit too much." And I learned a lot that day.
Yeah, I walk into a pitch meeting with a few ideas.
Yeah.
And if I'm really attached to it, then a paragraph, you know, the cell text on the back of the novel.
Yeah,
basically.
So tell us how you came up with the idea of Threefold, and what other ideas did you have on that short list that didn't get picked?
I don't remember what ideas we had because it's such a huge list. Like, they all jumble together after you pick one. They all kind of avalanche onto each other.
I
don't remember the ones that we didn't pick. I don't even remember the ones we didn't pick for Dawn of Flame. I just remember sitting in the meeting going, you know, "You're telling me to pick something that I'm passionate about, that I like the idea of. I want to see what people think of when we tell them you're going inside the sun."
Yeah.
That's what I want.
Yeah.
And in this case, I said, we have all these great, like, creatures called the Unseen, this loose and not really coalition of conspiracy theory-based species.
Yeah.
I want to tell that story. I'm a huge fan of the X-Files.
Right.
So I want to get a little bit of that into Starfinder, you know.
The Starfinder in the core rulebook has this section, and it, in my opinion, it might be the most used section of the book, maybe even more than the tactical rules, where it goes through all the various factions in the Starfinder setting, in the Packworld setting. And those antagonists, you can look at them, and virtually every one of them has gotten an AP. You've got the Aslanti Empire and you know, each of those factions. But finally, we get to the Unseen is one of those factions, and it must have been a challenge to sort of come up with a plot that would, because like you know, like they're not really a faction; they're really
They're not really a faction.
They're a bunch of kind of other groups that are all kind of at war with each other.
Yeah, I mean, the Unseen is what conspiracy theorists in the pack world call this group of people, as if it is a coalition. And even they know it's not a coalition.
Right.
So, at least in theory. they suspect that the reptoids aren't working with the grays. In fact, they're probably working at counter purposes and stuff like that. It's just that they take all of these unseen enemies and just lump them into one category, which is what we are wont to do, I guess, to put things in their boxes. But
pattern seeing species.
Yeah.
So you pitched a bunch of different ideas, and we went with the unseen, the threefold conspiracy. Did it always have a name?
No, I mean, coming up with the name of the AP is one of the most challenging things, because you got to come up with an idea of what you want to call it, and then you make a list, you make a short list. Rob takes the short list to Eric. Eric shoots it all down. You go back and you make five more names, and then you which is Eric's job. I'm not decrying that. That's you know, he wants to make something pop and sell. That's fine. That's great. And it needs to be something like Age of Ashes or the Threefold Conspiracy or Dawn of Flame or Attack of the Swarm. You know,
yeah,
it
right.
needs to be that. Attack of the Swarm is great because it harkens to those like those newsreels where you know. And Keeley even wrote the promo video to kind of do that. But I do remember that we were sitting in a meeting about. And I said, what really attracts me the most on this list is right now is the unseen. So let's do something with the unseen. And I don't remember exactly what I proposed at the time, because I'm sure it wasn't exactly what Threefold ended up being. Because everything always evolves, right? And you write something, then you get another idea because what you wrote inspires something. So you have to add that, and then you change something else. So it evolves, but... I remember that Rob was pretty enthusiastic about the idea of using the unseen.
Yeah, he's an old-time conspiracy nerd too.
Yeah,
yeah.
And Owen really liked it too. I remember he liked it so much that despite not wanting to take on more freelance, he took on an entire AP volume for.
He wrote number two, right?
Yeah, he wrote number two,
which I think is out now.
Yeah.
I
think it came out at the end of March.
Yeah,
I get kind of discombobulated because I get it a little early.
Okay.
I get it like 2 weeks early, I think, somehow. I don't know why. But yeah, it should be out now. It was out at the end of March.
Right on. So then after the pitch is approved, it's your job to outline it.
Right.
And
so there's pitch, there's the pitch, then it's like, okay, well, what is each volume going to be about? So that's another meeting, right? Or three. Narrowing down what each volume is going to be. Each volume kind of has to be its own contained thing, like its own beginning, middle, and end in the bigger beginning, middle, and end of the AP arc. So so you nail that out. And when you have that pretty much figured out, that's when you start outlining.
So when you were at that stage, can you tell us about what you wanted the AP to do and maybe how it did change or evolve over some of the process?
Well, the main thing that we wanted it to do, and I say we because it is a collaborative process, even though it's something like, you know, Rob, and if it's your turn to be the lead developer, Rob and Keeley will want you to do what you like, what you want, something that you feel good about, but it's still collaborative. And our major goal was that it was like any good conspiracy thriller where the layers get peeled away slowly. So the main focus was that you don't see the whole picture. And as you start to see more of the picture, you realize there's way more that you don't know.
Right. So the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know.
Right, exactly. And in kind of an oh shit sort of way, like, what are we involved in? What is going on here? Like, are we just losing our minds? What's happening? Like,
and this could be a real challenge in a gaming sense. I mean, it's different to write that in a television series or a novel where you're controlling all the characters, but at a game, players feel like they deserve agency, right? And a lot of what you're doing is taking away some of that. We're just making it kind of unsatisfying intentionally because they're confused all the time. The confusion is supposed to be the satisfaction.
Although the confusion is never consistent. So it's not pervasive, in other words. So you're in one place and you think you know what's going on, and you're acting with certainty, you're acting with agency, you're doing what you think you need to do.
Right.
And then the layer gets peeled off and you're like, oh, okay, now we'll move on. And then you do the other thing with certainty and agency, and then another layer gets peeled off, and it's like, oh, okay, that's what's going on. And then so horror is a similar challenge in that you have to make things at least seem scary. You know, it's really hard to scare players at the table when they're sitting around eating potato chips and drinking Mountain Dew or whatever.
Yeah.
and the lights are on, right? But you can still make things, you can still evoke the images without making it feel like it's being forced. And I think that was the major challenge of, one of the major challenges of Threefold Conspiracy, because making it so you felt like you were acting with some certainty until the other foot dropped. And then it's like momentary confusion. And then, okay, we have some clear, we still have clear choices here, right?
Yeah. So
there's momentary, like, we don't know what's going on, but we still know what we need to do. We still think we need to know what we need to do.
And that can have create some possibilities for some very heroic moments and choices where, yes, we don't understand what's going on. We know that we're being lied to, but we also know we have to save this person, right? And it allows us to focus on the small, and put the big away for a minute.
It also lets you do things that flip certain tropes on their head, like, but also allow players to do what players often want to do, such as thumb their nose at authority.
Yeah,
because they think they get to a point where they're like, we can't trust this authority.
Yeah.
So we need to figure out if we need to undermine it. And in order to figure out if we need to undermine it, we need to undermine it just a little bit, no matter what.
To find out if we need to undermine it more.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, well, we were right. We need to get these guys. Yeah. They're not who we thought they were.
Yeah, you're right. Players love to thumb their nose at authority. I think that's a very American thing. We like to rebel. And it seems to me like in an adventure path like this, where we're acknowledging from the beginning that the GM may be lying to you, right?
Right.
There's some buy-in for the players, right? Like we're kind of all, it's like a horror campaign. We're all agreeing to play this kind of game, and so when the GM reveals that everything you thought you knew was a lie, you're okay with that because that's the AP you signed up for.
Right. I think part of the key, though, is it's not going to be everything.
Okay.
In the end, you're going to be right about some things.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you see it all the time when you're playing these games. You know what I'm talking about. Like, at least one of your friends, you're talking to every NPC you talk to, one of your friends is like, I don't trust this guy.
Right. And he's right.
And in this case, he was right not to trust that guy. So.
Yeah. Yeah, we do have a unique opportunity to plant some of those seeds. So that, and you know, I we don't want to spoil the adventure path, especially Threefold, which is so much about keeping secrets, but
and that was one of the challenges of promoting this adventure series is promoting it, making it sound exciting without revealing the plot, right?
The number of conversations I've had with Keeley in which he says, like on a panel at Gen Con or in a podcast stream or something, where he says, I can't tell you what's going to happen. I can't, I don't want to reveal it, but it's a really fine line to walk with this. I mean, Attack of the Swarm, we at least had like, okay, we know that the Swarm is invading and we know that they're going to conquer the planet and they're going to be on the run. But even that's kind of very, very vague top line. We can't really say about Threefold Conspiracy. It spoils everything.
Yeah, I mean, in Attack of the Swarm, the promo material could be newsreel-like. I mean, you could say exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
in broad strokes without spoiling anything. You can't do that. That's what one of the most challenging things was writing the cell text. You know, what do we call them at Paizo? The what you put in the spreadsheet for the catalog.
Oh, the I can't believe I've forgotten it. Solicitation.
Solicitations, yeah. So I call it cell text. It's the back of the book text, basically, that describes what you're buying.
Yeah, I had to write the first one of those for the first Fly Free or Die adventure not too long ago. I didn't want to spoil anything, but I will say that, but there is a connection between the first adventure path, you know, and the end. Like the end pays off the beginning.
Right.
Right. And that's something we wanted to get. We want to have that feeling of reward and that feeling of completion. I remember when you wrote the video narration for Dawn of Flame, where you did the whole thing narrated from the big bad guy's point of view.
Right.
Which is a great way for us to learn more about that character because he doesn't show up until the sixth volume. But you can get an idea for him really, really. You hear him talking, which we don't do in a role-playing game at all. But you can't do that in Threefold Conspiracy. You can't have the big bad guy, whoever there is, if there even is one.
Right.
You can't have that person talking in the video text. Like, that would spoil everything.
Yeah, that's true. I think that whenever I do outlines, whenever I was doing outlines for APs, I wrote the solicitation text during the outline phase.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Now it might change before I actually upload it to the spreadsheet. You know, I might revise it now once the outline is done and stuff like that. And once I know because by the time some of the solicitations are going in, you actually have developed some of the adventures.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can change them to be a little more precise, but it was still, I think that was one of the biggest challenges with this one, was saying something without saying enough to give it away.
So the first,
because a lot of these adventures have endings or climaxes that result in you discovering something that you couldn't possibly have known.
Yeah. Right.
There was just no way to know it. Right.
Yeah, in a mystery, there's this notion in mysteries of the fair play mystery, right? Where they put the clues to the murder. Agatha Christie is famous for these. Mm-hmm. Ellery Queen is another one. Where they put the clues to the murder in the book. And if you're smart and you're attentive, you can figure out the killer from the clues. But then there's X-Files, right? which is exactly like, you know, this show just gets batshit crazy. And there's no way to predict what's going to happen. In fact, that unpredictability, that fact that something happened that you had no way of knowing about, is part of the genre.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's also a lot of fun. So my goal, and part of this peeling the onion layer by layer goal, is that at the end of each adventure, or at some point in each adventure, the players say, "What?"
That mind-blown moment.
Like, yeah. What? Okay, that changes things a bit.
Who wrote the first one?
Keeley.
That was Keeley, that's right, yeah, yeah.
He really wanted to write that volume because he wanted to write the mystery volume. It's a literal murder mystery. I
mean, right, right.
Or it's not a murder mystery, but it's somebody disappears and what happened to her, right?
So. Yeah. And that one came out about a month ago. You've had the first couple of them out. I got to write the third one.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time that was happening, you had already left Paizo and moved back to Austria with your family.
Right.
So we hired you on to continue developing it as a freelancer.
Right. So I developed Owen's Flight of the Sleepers and your Deceiver's Moon as a freelancer.
And just to give an obvious, so I'm going to apologize in public here because I totally screwed up something in that adventure and you very graciously fixed it. So the cover art is commissioned long before the adventure is written.
Yeah, that's something that most people don't know, like that's how right. far in advance that stuff happens.
Yeah. And so when you wrote the outline and you sent the outline to me, to all of us, the cover art was already decided and the villain was already there in the cover art. And he's clearly like a heavily armored mercenary with a huge gun. And I made him like an operative with like a switchblade knife. and so he totally did not, because I didn't check. I forgot to check the art for that character. And so I wrote up all of his stats and made this whole big bad guy, but with the wrong, he didn't fit the art. And so you had to go back and change him and make him into a soldier with a big ass gun. Right. So, yeah. But this is part of the developer's job is catching rookie mistakes, which I should have known better.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that that's one of the problems with commissioning this art. It locks us in ways that I don't think that other people that I don't think people outside the industry understand the way that functions. So because of the way promotion and functions and catalogs and needing to cover for other display purposes, you need to have all that locked down. And if that character, not only is that character in going to be in the book somewhere as a villain or an ally, it could be an ally or just an interesting monster, really.
Right.
There's a scene behind that character that also occurs in the book.
That's right, because Kaizo's art style, our adventure paths are always the same style. They've always got a front figure,
right,
who eventually hit that art will get reused for the pawn,
right,
and then a back illustration with usually a couple of the iconic characters in a firefight or some kind of confrontation, usually an action scene,
right.
And I remember when I was working on Dawn of Flame, you were like, okay, we're gonna put these Void Hags on the cover.
Right.
You okay with a Void Hag somewhere in the adventure? And I'm like, hell yeah, Void Hags are awesome.
Yeah.
And from that we developed, you know, the whole sort of covenant and everything. But that encounter was decided before I even got the assignment.
Yeah. I mean, it gives you some leeway, but it means that if something appears in that image, it should occur somewhere in the book.
Yeah.
And I really like that image because, you know, the Dawn of Flame whole motif is so hot orange and stuff. And that image with the hags is so cool and blue.
Yes.
And it doesn't really say what is about to happen. It's like she's doing something strange and the two iconics are there kind of.
But it could be a peaceful resolution. It could be a first encounter where you're like, okay, we don't know what we're going to do yet. No one's opened fire yet.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and that's cool because the Dawn of Flame, that particular adventure has this. There's a lot of ways that encounter can play out.
There is a lot of ways. I have a way that I hope it plays out at most tables.
Yeah,
because it's just cooler. But and I watched another video podcast that was. I call it a video podcast because the people aren't on the. It's video, but the people aren't actually on the screen. It's like their characters and the map and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And they had cut a deal with the Void Hags, but at the final encounter, they also had robes handy. So we'll just say what they had Void Hag robes handy. So that says something.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. All right. So speaking of, by the way, of the art design, have you seen, I'm sure you've looked at the 3-4 Conspiracy adventures.
Yeah.
Adam Vick, who does a lot of our graphic design and layout on the Starfinder for the Starfinder team, this adventure path looks so great. Like the color design and the page design, we call it the page treatment, which is all of the stuff that goes around the outside borders and the way that the whole thing kind of comes together uniformly. It just looks so great. We owe so much to the art team.
Yeah, and I'm often pleased when a character looks like what I pictured her to look like the character on the front of the Chimera Mystery looks like I hope she would look like, maybe a little too clean, but beside that she looks really cool. But I also love it because she doesn't look exactly like I pictured her. It's clearly the artist's interpretation, and so I get to be surprised by the art. But there's also another cool experience in doing this job, and that is that sometimes you're so surprised by the art, but it's so good that you change the writing to match. Yeah. like there's some detail there that just must be brought out further in the writing. And
I remember we were working on Signal of Screams and we got this art in and it was basically a blob made of eyeballs.
Yeah.
And it was nothing like what we had originally intended the monster to do, but we just rewrote the monster to fit the new art.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
We've since hired an in-staff artist, by the way. I don't know if you ever met, if you've met Ken.
No, I didn't get a chance.
But he did some design work on the Devastation arc, the sieves that show up in the Devastation arc.
Has that been announced?
It has. Like so many weird things at Paizo, it gets kind of stealth announced when the product page shows up.
Mm-hmm.
So like you, so, and the same thing is true of, so Threefold Conspiracy is 6 chapters. And then there's a 3-chapter Devastation arc that picks up after that. And that's our first high level AP. So it's levels 13 to 20.
Right. And we that's a 3-piece, the 3-part one.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough to be involved in the planning of that. So.
Oh, good. Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah. And the adventure's a little bit longer. Like we took some of the pages from Back Matter.
Mm-hmm.
And push them into the adventures because we just know that high-level adventures just require more room. Stat blocks are longer. There's more possibilities players can do because they have access to high-level abilities, and you kind of have to contingency plan a little bit more. But then and then Fly Free or Die comes after that, which is the next AP. And this month, like a couple of weeks ago, the first adventure in Fly Free or Die showed up on the product page, which, and I was shocked because I thought we haven't announced it. We haven't, like, I expected a big sort of PR thing, but this is how things show up first. They show up when the product page appears, and it's got a placeholder cover, just like a lot of the, just like all the Extinction Devastation arc, all placeholder covers. So there will be a product here eventually, but for now there's just a web page, and that's how players find out about a lot of these things.
Yeah. Is there a lot of excitement about Devastation Arc?
I think so, yeah, because quite frankly, a lot of players have been looking forward to high-level play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's often some common wisdom that high-level adventures don't sell as well because fewer people have high-level characters. But
it is proven data that most people's campaigns stop at about 12th or 13th level.
Yeah, or if they get that far, right? Like, a lot of games don't even last that long. But it also becomes something of a self-fulfilling prophecy because Starfinder is a game about levels 1 to 20, and we have put out zero content for levels 13 and up. And so what do you – like, if you've leveled up to 13, are you going to go play Starfinder Society – scenarios for the rest of your career? Like, maybe you want an adventure path, and those are great scenarios. I'm not at all, you know, disparaging the scenario play, but
well, and another thing is, like, so you give a GM levels 1 through 13 and then it ends, except for maybe the stuff that we give them for continuing the campaign.
Yeah.
And then what's supposed to happen? Is the GM going to take the time to make up levels 14 through 20, which is challenging design? Or just start a new campaign? I mean,
it's especially challenging when we have given you no models. Like when it came time for me to write a Starfinder adventure, I went straight to Dead Sons number one. I went straight to Incident at Absalom Station. Right. And I looked at how Rob had written that adventure, which was designed to show how to write Starfinder adventures. Like it's an archetypal adventure. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was running for my home group, when I had just moved to Seattle, and I wrote an adventure sort of modeling from that one. So I had some instructions, you know, but we haven't had anything like that until Devastation Arc. And so I think my hope is that once we get this 3-part adventure path out and people can see what high level play is like, they can start writing some of their own and they'll feel more confident playing at those high levels. And excitement has been pretty high. Of course, it's anecdotal. I don't have any data to back it up. Mm-hmm. But yeah, people seem excited to see it. I mean, who's going to say no? It's like level 13 to 20. It threatens the destruction of the entire Pact worlds. It's, you know, this massive, like, planet destroying thing coming in, and you have to fight it off with an entire fleet. I mean, how do you say no to that? It's great. It's like Death Star.
Well, I mean, it's like, that's another thing that I really like about Starfinder. We were talking about earlier how you get all these genres mixed in.
Yes.
But it also allows us to pay homage to, like, so many of the things that we love in different forms of genre fiction, from horror to sci-fi, fantasy, science fantasy.
Yeah.
I mean, all of the things that we've written contain pointers to the popular media in one way or another and stuff like that. So
there are a lot of science fiction RPGs out there. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of even science fantasy RPGs out there. But there's no science fantasy RPG without an IP, right? Like, I mean, Star Wars is basically space wizards, right? Right? You're space wizards and you're space paladins. But it's all wrapped up in the Star Wars IP. And so it's hard to just do a lot of the crazy stuff that people will say, well, that doesn't feel like Star Wars to me.
Right.
Starfinder embraces all of these genres, and you can go from X-Files conspiracy theories to diving into the sun to Starship Troopers style military action against the swarm to Star Wars Death Star type adventure. And you can do all of that, and it fits. Like, it totally works. It's one of the beauties of this game.
And I really actually take it even a little bit further. I think that you could do Road Warriors of Akaton, you know, go all the way down to this micro level where you're fighting in the ruined cities of abandoned cities of Akaton in junk vehicles with high-tech weapons that you've stolen from the starport, all the way up to, like, exploring the galaxy, right?
Owen is doing this Gamma Finder project.
You mentioned that too, yeah.
Yeah. Where he's just taking the Starfinder rules and showing you how to do post-apocalyptic adventure with it in the Gamma World setting. And, of course, it fits great. I mean, it's a perfect fit. And I grew up on, like, Thunder the Barbarian.
Yeah.
The Starfinder cartoon, if there ever was one, right? You've got a big, monstrous dude. You've got someone with a Solarian laser sword. And you've got a character who casts spells. I mean, that's your team. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a wonderfully flexible genre, and I agree. And Junk Lords of Akaton is one of the Adventure Path pitches on that list that we look at every 6 months. And one of these days, it's going to rise to the top. So
I don't know if I added that or not. Maybe not. Maybe I'm just influenced by seeing it. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But the idea that you can go all the way down to that type of micro level. And you could have an entire campaign,
yes,
set like that. I mean, where you start out as road warriors and you end up as, you know, warlords that control some section of the planet or whatever you want to do. You know,
we've talked about. There hasn't been anything decided and no announcements or anything. But one of the things that we would really like to see is some self-contained, quote unquote, modules, which is what Paizo calls one-shot adventures. Right, something along the scale of The Fall of Plaguestone, which is the adventure that Bowman wrote for Pathfinder 2nd Edition, that's just kind of a self-contained evergreen starter adventure for level 1 characters. It doesn't tie into an adventure path. It takes you from, like, level 1 to level 3 or level 4, and you learn the experience of the game, and then it launches you, and then the GM can do whatever they want to do after that, right? You can create your own campaign. We would love to see some self-contained adventures for Starfinder at different levels, with touching some of these genres. And I think that the Akaton Warlord campaign or adventure would be a great way for us. Like, it would be a great module. I would love.
Did you ever see the mini games in Polyhedron?
Yeah.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
I think that's what I want to see for Starfinder. I want to see an adventure that also all the back matter is giving you is continuing the campaign, right?
Yeah.
That it's a whole setting. So you have a book that is not just an adventure. It's like 12 pages of setting material that lets you just keep going with that idea. So it would be like Gamma Finder.
Yes.
But I would even like to see it set in, you know, like there's a planet, I can't remember what it's part of the Aslanti Empire, but
okay.
That was devastated by nuclear war. And one of the species is from that planet and they can take off their limbs and stuff like that. But you could set it on a specific Starfinder
yes.
place. It wouldn't have to be, you know, totally removed from the Starfinder universe. It could actually right. be part of the Starfinder galaxy. It's just that the technology isn't so evolved that people are getting off the planet all the time or whatever.
That's right.
So
yeah.
Well, it would be fantastic.
It would be super fun. And again, showing off the broad genres that Starfinder can encompass.
Yeah.
And it would, and that could become a player option thing too. So like the most popular character choice in Starfinder is the icon theme. Like every group has at least one icon theme in it, right? Somebody's a video blogger or a social media star. And imagine
I was the icon in the developer game.
Right there. There you go. So imagine if your social media star gets stuck on Junk Lords of Akaton, yeah. right? And you can bring that genre with you into the Road Warrior genre. And then the mix of those two genres will give you endlessly entertaining play at the table.
Well, and because it's part of the Starfinder galaxy, you always have the option of uplifting it. So even if it's isolated to the planet for yeah. some reason, you could decide that either for some episodes or as the level advances, that it moves off the planet.
Right, right.
So there's always that option.
Well, I have kept you for almost an hour. Thank you so much, Chris.
Has it been an hour, Harvey?
It has been. And it's such a pleasure to catch up with you again. I hope that you and your family are safe and sane in this crazy virus time.
Yeah, I hope you're well too. It was my pleasure to be here.
And we'll get you. You're doing other work now. Since then, since you've left Paizo, you've got a bunch of other new stuff that you're working on.
Yes,
which we haven't even had a chance to talk about. I totally forgot. Tell us about some of that. Draculola was your Kickstarter that recently successfully funded.
Yeah, Draculola is a character that my 8-year-old made up based on her costume for what's called Fasching, which is carnival in Austria.
Nice.
So she likes vampires, and she made up this little vampire girl that doesn't want to be a mean vampire. So,
okay.
And I was excited about the idea, and I started talking to her about it. And because I was excited, of course, that enthused her. And then she started making up all this stuff about it. You know, where does Dracula live? Who are her parents? You know, and my littler daughter, she started making up who does Dracula have any little brothers or sisters? You know, stuff like that. So,
right.
So I made up the rules. I've been playing around with different versions of the rules. You might have seen them.
I have.
I haven't decided on which one I'm going to pick yet, funny enough.
Oh, but, really?
I mean, which core mechanic? I have three different core mechanics that might go into the game. I know which one works the best, so I'll probably use that one, which I actually haven't shown in public yet. But okay. But so I'm just the mechanical designer, really. The little girls are doing most of the story,
and the player characters are monster children.
Yeah, they're monsters
rebelling against their parents.
Basically, I mean, so most and the parents are typical monsters that would be mean to people and stuff like that. Whereas the kids would help people and stuff like that because Draculola, that's what she wants to do.
And this happened as a result of the fanzine Kickstarter month. Well,
funny enough, I wrote Draculola just because we came up with it and I wanted to.
Okay.
And it just I didn't even know what Zine Quest was. It just happened that I had something that was publishable in that format. And I was like, well, I mean, this is a great opportunity to do a dry Kickstarter run. Yeah. I've never run a Kickstarter before, so I'll just.
Did you learn a lot?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah,
I did. Yeah. A lot of valuable insight that will go into my next Kickstarter.
Can you tell us what that will be?
Well, I have, it's pretty likely that my very next Kickstarter will be a smaller adventure that is system agnostic, but fantasy.
Okay. Yes.
Then I'm going to do a larger adventure that is also system agnostic and fantasy, but it's for a concept that I've come up with that gives you three pillars for a campaign. So it's the beginning, a middle, and an end of a campaign. So all three adventures share elements. So the big bad guy or the plot is carried through. And it also gives you interlude material for between those adventures.
Okay.
So you can play other adventures that your GM makes up and stuff between these adventures, because you're going to need to level up between them. But they're all tied together, and it gives the GM material to kind of weave into the in between space, so you never lose the thread. But it has a climax.
I was chatting with Leo Glass, one of my fellow editors at the time, and he was running Starfinder. And he's like, yeah, we played through the first two adventures of Dead Sons, but now my players have all this stuff they want to do. So we're just going to wander off the adventure path and come back to it later.
Right.
And that's exactly what players want to do. There's a lot to be said for the adventure path, and it's very well structured, and a lot of players and GMs flourish in that environment. Mm-hmm. But a lot of tables, they want to wander. You know, and so that kind of milestone where you've got like an early adventure, a central adventure that reminds everybody what's going on and probably gives a big twist, and then a final adventure that brings it all together with a lot of room in between.
It also allows me to do something that I think is important in adventure design, and that is to build resonance with certain things. So in the first adventure, there are things that remain undone that – in the second adventure, you get to choose to do, right?
I see.
And then the final adventure and the intervening material is often a consequential resolution of all of that stuff.
I see. Okay. So like somebody didn't take out the trash, so you got to take out the trash. And then now the trash has been taken out.
More like in the first one, you saw a problem that you were incapable of solving because of your power level.
Yes. Yes.
So you're like, we're going to plan, we're going to figure out how to go back and do this thing, and then we're going to do it. And then it moves on from there. So,
and that kind of payoff where the player characters feel like they come up with a plan and they execute the plan and it works and we have a successful plan. Like that can be really rewarding at the table. Players can really remember those moments.
And it's also great when you meet a foe that you knew was beyond you, and then you get to come back and meet that foe again, but he's not beyond you. Right. So
yeah, that's a classic 2-hour Hollywood story arc right there. Right.
Right.
That's
Except we're playing it out over, you know, hopefully what is months in game world or in the game world or whatever.
Now you describing these as system agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
Will they have no stats or multiple stats, or how are you want to do that?
So I'm going to have appendices that have stats for specific games and suggestions for how to use the material in the main book in specific games.
Okay. Okay.
Part of that is that I want to write system agnostic so it can be as usable widespread as possible. But another is it's a marketing angle. And the marketing angle is that I can put the appendices in different places where they belong and it will point to the main book. Like if I have D&D 5th edition stats in an appendix, I can put that on the DM's Guild, for example.
Just the appendix.
Right, just the appendix. And the appendix will point back to the main book.
Right, yeah, right on.
And the appendix will probably be pay what you want, whereas the main book won't be pay what you want.
So, but the appendix is literally, it's just game stats. It's got nothing from the adventure in it. It's just a bunch of stat blocks.
I think that if you were clever, you could probably extrapolate, but it's definitely not enough. It's definitely not the main book. I mean,
You could use those stat blocks for anything.
Right.
But if you want the story, we go back to your core book, your main adventure.
And my actual plan is that, so the first adventure is, the first three adventures are, I'm eventually going to do another book that's the same way, but they're going to be designed to go together.
Okay.
So you could take the first three and take the second three and put them together and have six adventures that actually fit together.
I see. Well, you sort of go back and forth between the two books.
Right. They work just fine not together, but they speak to each other enough that they could be slotted together.
That is fascinatingly complicated. But that would be quite a coup to pull off. That sounds super exciting. I would love to see that.
Yeah, I hope I get it done.
Is there anything else that you're working on right now that you can talk about or that you'd like to talk about?
In the gaming world?
Sure.
I'm just chugging along, working on different freelance stuff too. I mean, I'm working on some Starfinder stuff. I seem to always be working on at least a little bit of Starfinder stuff,
yeah,
which is cool. A little bit of Pathfinder stuff. And my main job right now is actually doing a culture magazine here in Austria. Well, not here in Austria. I'm in Virginia right now, actually, but in Austria.
So, and you're locked in Virginia. You can't, or can you leave? Can you fly?
That remains to be seen. The plane that I would fly out on is a weekly plane, and it's been canceled for the last 3 weeks. So we'll see. I'm not supposed to leave for 3 weeks, but we'll see. I'll check in about 2 weeks and see what happens. I mean, I can move my flyout date because of the airlines being pretty liberal with moving that stuff around now. But
now that they need us, they're willing to give us some flexibility now that they need us.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thanks again for coming on and for telling us about all of your work and checking in with Starfinder. And I look forward to having you do more, a lot more on this game in the future. We've been so lucky to have you. And you taught me so much when I was at that desk.
Hey, I'm grateful to be here. And I'm also grateful to have you as a friend. So,
all right. Well, thanks, everyone. And we'll see you again next time. I think we're going to try and get Keely on next week to talk about the second half of Threefold, when he picked up from you and how the arc changed or didn't change and what we kept. Of course, he's going to say, I can't spoil the ending, but like, how many times?
Yeah.
But we'll see what he can talk, and probably we'll get to Devastation Arc as well. Thanks, everyone.